So, week 7. So here's how it works. If you looked at the syllabus, or never looked at the syllabus, rather, we have 12 lessons, but one of them was just so monstrous, I broke it up into 3 weeks. That one's coming up. That's about the appointed times, the Moedim, all the holy days. There was no way we were going to get through every holy day with any sort of, you know, credibility in one evening in 45 minutes. So we broke that up. So it's 12 sessions in 14 weeks, 16 calendar weeks, because we are skipping 2 weeks. It's not coming up for a little while, but Thanksgiving or the day before or after, I don't know, November 24th, we're not having class. And then the first night of Hanukkah, December 8th, we're not having class either. So just a reminder on that. So session 7, the synagogue traditions in worship. Basically tonight what we're going to be talking about are the elements that exist, physical things that you will see inside most synagogues, including messianic ones. Most of the stuff we're going to discuss we have here, and I'm going to show you guys, and you can handle some things that you might not have otherwise, you know, seen up close. And so we're going to do all that. Yeah, that's not prime seating for taking notes. So let me just back up a minute. Last week we talked about the historical split from the 100 years where followers of Yeshua existed within the synagogue system, and then where the split started to happen, where this institution called the church started to come to be, why it happened and who was responsible for it and how it came to be. And so we had concluded last week that although this, quote, church system has existed for a very long time, we in this movement and in this building, in this congregation, we desire to follow Yeshua in the way that his followers followed him and in the way that he worshipped. And that's where the synagogue system, or I should say the synagogue style, is much more fitting, incredibly more fitting, because we honor Torah here, and that's... with Yeshua at the heart of that, that's the root of what we do. So we're going to take a look at really some of the elements of a synagogue, specifically an Orthodox, and when I say Orthodox, I mean non-Yeshua following synagogue. So there are going to be some differences between what we see here. This building was not built as a synagogue. This building actually, I think, was built as a church a long time ago. It was Chosen People Ministries purchased it. It became their office. This is a meeting room, and Besar Shalom inhabits this conference room. So this building in particular was never intended to be a synagogue. It was never intended to be really a place of messianic worship. So there's some, you know, things that would be different if we were to have built our own building, obviously. So we'll get there. I'm getting ahead of myself. So here's the deal. Oh, hold on a sec. Just a moment. Where's that little thing? There it is. Excuse me. I have to rig up this little system so that my notebook and all this stuff fits up here at the same time. There we go. Set to go. All right, so... along with the destruction of the temple, the sacrifices and the priesthood also ended. So it wasn't just a building that was destroyed. It was a system that went out of place. We've talked about this a lot already. Without the temple, there was no priesthood. And without the priesthood, there was no sacrifice. Without the sacrifice, this whole system fell apart. The root of Jewish worship was non-existent. And suddenly. And we've talked about the history of how that... what happened from that, how rabbinical Judaism came to exist, and the decisions that were made halakhically speaking, and how that has turned into what rabbinic Judaism looks like today. But the holy objects, which once captured the essence of the Jewish faith, were now gone. There was no more holy place. There was no more most holy place. There was no more altar of sacrifice or altar of incense. There was no more laver or menorah, or a table of the presence, or there was no veil, in Hebrew, the parochet. There is no Ark of the Covenant. These objects, which remained in the minds of the people as central symbols in their faith and worship, it's what they knew, it's what they, how they, their faith and their worship was defined. These things were no longer. leaving the Jewish people with a far greater sense of loss than merely losing the objects themselves. They didn't just lose this stuff. They lost the worship along that went along with it. It was a major, 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 major thing. It's four majors. They had lost their religion, essentially, and with it a significant part of their community and culture. So, the synagogue system, which had already been in place, became crucial. Because without the temple, all Jewish worship now existed within these synagogue buildings. The synagogue was never meant to replace the temple, at least not at this time, but it was meant to be a complement to it. And since the temple was destroyed, synagogues were then organized in a way that would remind a worshiper of the temple. Again, not meant to be a replacement, but meant to be a reminder, a shadow, if you will. So there are elements that started to exist within the synagogue that would point to the things that used to be in the temple. So what we're going to do tonight is go through kind of each of those objects one by one, talk about what their purpose is, what they are, and what they represent, what they reflect as far as the Second Temple was concerned. By the way, the word synagogue is a Greek word. It's the complement to the Hebrew word ekklesia, which we've talked about a lot, which means assembly or community. So that's what it means. It originally referred to a congregation, meaning a group of people, not necessarily a building, but just like many other words, I'm thinking of the word church also, which, you know, used to define a group of people, really starts to define the building as well that they meet in. Synagogues also has several other names. In Hebrew, it's called a Beit Tefillah, a house of prayer, or a Beit Knesset, which is also what the government buildings in Israel are called, the house of assembly. In Yiddish, you and we use this term around here. I use it just because it's the shortest and quickest word to say, but we can call it a shul, which a Yiddish word comes from the German word for school. So it's a house of study. It's a school. This is where we study. And specifically in Reform Judaism, and we talked about the fact that there's many different flavors of Judaism today and always, but only in Reform Judaism are synagogues called temples. And I didn't know this, actually, up until I started studying for this, but that was actually a very intentional decision to call it a temple, and because in Reform Judaism, they have made a declaration that they are no longer waiting for the rebuilding of the temple, no longer waiting for Messiah to come, and so their synagogues they called temples, because there's no temple in their minds, there's no temple coming. I think that's sad, because there is a temple coming, and Mashiach is coming back. And, well, every knee will bow one day, right? So, with that said, you know, yeah, I am preaching, that's right. When you're in the peanut section and you're this close, I hear you. Guys, man, I'll tell you. Rough is right. Loving. So, if you look through rabbinic writings, I know we spent an evening of love and joy and excitement talking about rabbinic writings. There's actually a surprisingly little amount in regards to what a synagogue should have and look like. Specifically, within different rabbinic writings, it says that a synagogue should have windows. And that relates to Daniel chapter 6, where it says Daniel prayed facing Jerusalem from his windows. And apparently, as far as rabbinic writings are concerned, every synagogue should have windows so that you can look out and pray facing Jerusalem. We, to the east, don't have windows. Do we? Oh, yeah, we do. We do. We got to start opening these blinds. I forgot about that window. The entrance, the main entrance to a synagogue should face Jerusalem. And if this is our main entrance, we do have that. There should be a vestibule, an area between the main entrance and the sanctuary. And I just think that's a good idea, not even spiritually speaking, just kind of logistically speaking. People come in, they, you know, get their business together. If you ever see me and my family or anyone with babies come in, you got 19,000 things on your arms. You make 11 trips to the car. We drop off the food in the table. I'm not ready to come in this room yet. You know, I'm not ready to worship. I'm not ready to be really a part of a spiritual experience. So a vestibule between so people can get themselves prepared. And I think that's a great idea. And then there's a couple objects, minimum number of objects that rabbinic writings would say a synagogue must have. They must have a Torah scroll. They must have a Ner Tamid, with that light above the ark, and we're going to talk about it specifically. That's a Ner Tamid, a constantly burning light. And in order to have a service, they must have a minyan. A minyan is 10 adult men gathering to pray, at least, obviously. So the sages of the rabbinic writings would say these are the things, these are the bare minimums. Anything else really is up to style. And if you visit synagogues anywhere all over the world, there's lots and lots of differences, especially coming into the modern age. You know, you can see anything. You can see a synagogue that looks like a church. You can see a synagogue that looks like a government building. You can see a synagogue that looks like, you know, an ancient great hall, and anything in between. So these are the essential elements of the synagogue. The remainder of the class, we're going to enumerate the physical aspects of a modern Orthodox synagogue, and then we're going to relate them to the manner in which it attempts to parallel the Second Temple. Like I said, synagogues since the destruction of the Temple have been designed specifically to remind one of the Temple experience. And yes, I know, 2,000 years later, we don't have that emotional connection to the Temple like someone would in the first century. But at least with the elements that we have here, we can get a taste. We can get an idea of what it was like, which I think is pretty cool. Yes, ma'am. That in order to have a prayer service, that there should be at least 10 adult men present. Right. And what defines an adult is someone who's had a bar mitzvah, who's been called up to read from the Torah already. So there's no age limit specifically set for that. Traditionally, it's around 12 or 13. But what signifies an adult within a synagogue is someone who is old enough and able to come up and read from the Torah. So before we understand the makings of the synagogue, I want to just talk quickly about what the Second Temple, and when I say the Second Temple, I mean the temple that stood in Yeshua's day, the one that was destroyed in 70 AD by the Romans. What the temple looked like as far as the layout. Okay, so it was kind of built in these like concentric rings. There were these courts that were built in one inside of another. So from the outermost going in, we started with the courtyard. And I'm just going to... Courtyard was used for weddings. The courtyard was used for building Sukkot during the Feast of Sukkot. It was used for celebrations for Simchat Torah, which, if you missed it this past Tuesday night, we had a great time celebrating Simchat Torah, the joy of the Torah, the beginning of the new Torah cycle. It was used for mikveh also, for immersions. So that was the general courtyard. Within the courtyard, there was the Court of the Women, a specific and separate section of the sanctuary, or a raised balcony. Oh, no, sorry. I'm getting ahead of myself. Within the Court of the Women, there was the Court of Israel. Within the Court of Israel was just the common sanctuary. What they called the sanctuary was called the Court of Israel. Then there was the HaKodesh, the holy place, which was in that. And then within the holy place was the most holy place, the Kodesh HaKodeshim. So that's what the temple consisted of, and I'm not gonna go through what each one represented. There are some diagrams in here. If afterward you want to take a look, just some kind of schematic layouts of what the temple looked like, and then what some famous synagogues look like. You guys are welcome to come look at that afterward. But with that in mind, we're gonna then look at the elements of the synagogue and how they relate to these things. So here we go. The first is called the Amud. The Amud is a reading stand. So these are all Hebrew words, and then, you know, I'm giving you the English translation of it. The Amud is a reading stand. The reading stand is symbolic of the altar of sacrifice. In the temple, what animals were sacrificed on, was slaughtered and burnt, the reading stand kind of takes the place of that. From this point, from the reading stand, the chazan, or the cantor, or the reader, someone who sings the blessings like I was doing this morning, that's where they lead the congregation from. Usually, we don't have one, but usually there's an embroidered cover on the reading stand, which is inscribed with one of two phrases. One, it could either say, "Know before whom you stand," which is kind of a daunting reminder, or, "I place the Lord constantly before me," which is a phrase that we use very often in our prayer together before we start to pray. Say, you know, I put the Lord before me always, setting our mind straight on what the purpose of our prayer is. And likewise, in a prayer service, setting our mind straight on what the purpose of our communal prayer is. So the Amud is meant to be a reminder symbolic of the altar of sacrifice. And I know some of you guys are taking notes, so I'm going to pause in between. Some of these have more information than others. I think some of you scratch. It's good. How many people actually ever look back at their notes? Don't lie. By the way, I think I forgot this last week, but there are discussion questions. I leave them up here. You can pick them up afterward. They're just extensions on what we talk about tonight, things to think about, things to continue in your own studies. So you can pick one up after we're done. So the Amud. That's it for the Amud. Here's a word you might be a little more familiar with. The Bima. That's this guy right here. Well, no, it isn't. It's where this would be. The Bima is the stage or the platform or the pulpit. It's a raised area where a reading desk where the Torah is read. It's usually elevated, and the reason it's elevated is this reference here, Nehemiah 8. I don't have the verse right in front of me, but in Nehemiah, this is when Ezra read the Torah to the whole people of Israel, and it says they built this wood platform for him to stand up on and proclaim so he could speak it to everybody. So the Bima is normally raised up. Like I said, this building was not built to be a synagogue. That's why we don't have those structures here. But to elevate it. Also, is that... Hold on. I want to see... I had another note in there. I didn't know if I put it in here later or not. To be called to the Torah, to come up to the Bima. You see on Shabbat morning, we have people come up and they read the Parsha. Frank does it oftentimes, so he'll invite other people to do it. Many of you have had the blessing to do that. That process is called making Aliyah. Aliyah is a Hebrew word which literally means to ascend or to go up. Well, if we have a raised platform, you're physically going up. But the idea, spiritually speaking, is to approach the Torah and to have the honor to read from it and speak from it is an ascension. Our prayer services in the morning, both on Shabbat and during our weekdays, are described as being an ascension. Much like if someone was to go to the temple in the temple days. The temple was all built with stairs. To get onto the first court, you had to climb some stairs. And to get to the next court, you had to climb some more stairs. And to get to the next court, you had to climb some more stairs. Which is why today, if you look, what's still standing in Israel, the Temple Mount is like way up high. The western wall is tall, and then the Temple Mount is above it. Because there were stairs leading up. And that the climbing those stairs was a spiritual process. You were going from the secular on the ground level and ascending to a holy place. So in the process of climbing those stairs, kind of like when I come in the building with 9,000 bangs and I'm not ready to come in this room yet, the idea is to prepare yourself to worship. So as you're climbing, you're preparing yourself. And our prayers in the morning reflect that. Going from something very secular, just waking up in the morning, you know, totally non-spiritual, and our prayers build in a way that we are coming and building toward Torah study. And the same is true here. So the Bima, like I said, is usually elevated by at least three steps to separate the reader from the congregation. Another analogy from that, Moses climbed a mountain to go get the Torah. God called him up. You know, it wasn't in a pit, and it wasn't in the common land where everybody else was. He called him up to this special place just for him. So to ascend to the Torah is analogous of that. You like that? That was for you, Harold. In the ancient synagogues, the Bima was separated from the Ark by a distance. Don't ask why. I don't know. But in modern synagogues, the Bima is often near the Ark. I guess, you know, if you're going to carry a Torah scroll, it's easy to bring it out of the Ark, put it right on the stand. So that's the Bima. The Aron HaKodesh, the Holy Ark. The Holy Ark symbolizes the most holy place where the Torah was placed in the Ark. It houses the Torah and sometimes other scrolls. And I'm going to show you... Oh, I'm already clipped up. I'm going to show you ours. Excuse me. So the Aron HaKodesh was meant to be a reminder of the Ark itself that the Torahs were kept in. We're going to go through each piece. They should be closed. But we have a veil. We have our Torah scrolls. We have several of them. Oftentimes in many synagogues, not only will you have a Torah scroll, but you also have Haftarah scrolls, so the writings of the prophets. And then you have the Megillot, the readings, like the book of Ruth and the book of Esther and the things that aren't within the Torah and the Haftarah. So that anything that would be read, anything that is the written word of God, would be held within here. And we're going to pull some stuff out of there in a little bit so you can see it. But I just want to give you a little bit more about the Aron HaKodesh itself. It's usually, not in our case, but it's usually positioned to face Jerusalem. And it's traditionally decorated with Jewish symbols, especially the tablets of the Torah, like pictures of the tablets themselves, lions or crowns or things like that to represent the kingship, to represent the godliness of the Torah itself. And when I say the Torah, I'm not talking about these physical objects. Obviously, we don't honor these objects as idols. That's not the idea. But what they represent and who they represent is what we give and pay homage to. When we open the Torah, or when we open the Ark, in our services, you'll notice we're always standing. It's a sign of respect for God's word. When the Torah is read, we're standing. When the Torah comes out of the Ark, we're standing. Right before we put the Torah back in the Ark, we're standing. When it's raised up and we say, this is the Torah that God placed before the children of Israel. The idea is to be, you know, if these are the words of the eternal God of the universe that he's laid down before us, the best we can do is honor him, I think, by standing. So that's what we do. It's out of respect for God's word and in remembrance of the Shekhinah, the presence of God, the visible presence of God over the Ark of the Covenant. In the temple itself, in the most holy place where the Ark of the Covenant was, that's where God physically resided, where the high priest once a year would be able to go in and experience that. He would see it, you know, hovering over the Ark. So the idea that we stand before it because it reminds us that the presence of God physically dwelt with that Ark in the temple at the time. Within the Ark, you'll see the velvety-looking veils. Veils called the parochet, a curtain or a veil. It covers the Ark, obviously not on the outside, but within it. It symbolizes the veil that separated the holy place from the most holy place in the temple. Within the temple itself, if you read through Exodus chapter 26 and other places, it talks about the construction of the Mishkan, the tabernacle, and then later the temple. And it was a thick curtain made of, like it says, blue, purple, and scarlet, and fine twisted linen. Modern synagogues usually use velvet or some similar material, and often around Yom Kippur, that is replaced with a white one to represent grace and to remember, you know, white is a symbol of grace or of forgiveness. So we have this separator, this veil, the parochet, that separates, or didn't, rather in the temple, separated the holy place from the most holy place. So now it's separating us from the Torah that is within it, because the Torah is representative and the Ark is representative of the Ark of the Covenant. Which brings us to the Torah itself. Anyone who's been here for a long time, what does Torah mean? Does Torah mean law? No, what does Torah mean? It's the teaching of God. Law is well, it might have been a more accurate translation than it's used today, but it's been so twisted, it's been so marred and maimed that the word law holds such a negative connotation to it that we simply don't use it. And it's really not even totally accurate. The word Torah means the teaching. Or specifically when we're talking about the Torah, we're talking about the books of Moses. The Torah scroll itself, the Sefer Torah. As far as an Orthodox synagogue is concerned, in order for a Torah scroll to be kosher, for it to be acceptable, it must be a handwritten scroll with black ink on parchment, sheepskin. It's not, you know, paper. It's photocopied. They're very, very, very expensive. And oftentimes ones that are purchased are very old. There are synagogues that have 400-, 500-, and 600-year-old Torah scrolls, and have many, some of them, but you can spend tens of thousands of dollars on them. Our Torah scrolls would not be considered kosher within Orthodox Judaism because they're not these things. But as far as what they represent and what they can be used for, these are perfectly acceptable. As far as the study of the Torah is concerned, there are both a one-year cycle for reading the Torah, which is what we follow, the one-year cycle. Every year we start again, which is what we did today. But there's also what's called a triennial, a three-year cycle, that I know several other Messianic congregations that follow. The sections for each Shabbat, the parashot, the portions, the singular word for that is parsha, they're broken up so that we have a digestible amount of scripture for us to study on a weekly basis. Each one has a name, each one has a theme, and they're the same ones that we study from year to year, obviously with more and more new and exciting information within them. The Torah itself is the central object of Judaism. It's her most sacred religious object. Without the Torah, Judaism doesn't exist. It's how it's defined. And that makes sense, because within it is prescribed the method that God has given us to worship him. So without the Torah itself, and I don't mean without a Torah scroll, but I mean without the Torah, there is no Judaism. There is no worship of God. That's how he has shown us to do it. A Torah scroll is handled with tremendous care and respect, so much so that if a Torah scroll is ever damaged beyond repair, it's never destroyed or thrown away. A Torah scroll is buried in a tallit, wrapped in a tallit, our prayer shawl. They would be wrapped in that and buried, stored in a special repository called a geneza until its burial, treated really like a person. The scroll is never to be worshipped, and we said that before. It is never made to be seen as an idol. The thing itself is not important. What's contained within it is what we honor, is what we remember, is what we study, and is what we define our worship through. The Torah itself, and you can see within the Ark, if you got a good look at it, the Torah is dressed in vestments, reminiscent of the high priest. You see, it has a robe, and in many other congregations, you'll see atop the handles, there will be crowns. And so it's adorned with these things. And the idea is to be a reminder of the high priest. The high priest wore these vestments. On his mantle and on his shoulders were hung different things that were that God had prescribed for the high priest to wear. And so we dress the Torah up in similar fashion. The mantle or the wrapper is, as far as I can't even remember, is it red? It's blue. The big one's blue, isn't it? Thank you, guys. Oh, yeah, it's blue. Yeah, thanks. Just like in many places, just like the veil is replaced with the white one on Yom Kippur, sometimes the mantle is replaced with the white one on Yom Kippur also. The mitre or the crown, we don't have that on ours. It can be on the top of the Torah scrolls. And then also sometimes there are bells hung from the wrapper. And then also a breastplate, just like the priest's breastplate hanging from the front. There is also, I do want to show you this. It's a pointer. Excuse me, Morris. You're good. The idea is that when we study from the Torah is to never really make physical contact with it, so it's just to preserve it. So if one is reading from it, the type is very small and everything's packed together. If you've ever seen traditional Hebrew writing, there's very little space even between words, let alone between letters. So it's just long blocks of print. So instead of following it with your finger and getting your oils all over the stuff, and then we use this thing called a yad. Yad is the Hebrew word for hand. I'll pass this around, but it's this ornate little pointer that has a little human hand with a finger on it. And the idea is, to follow your way through the Torah so you don't ever have to make physical contact with it. This is a nice one, so you can pass that around so everyone can see it. Like I'm in my classroom, back and forth. The yad is a pointer shaped like a hand that's used to read. I said that. The Torah scroll has, within a kosher Torah scroll, there's no vowel points. If you know anything about Hebrew, to read Hebrew successfully, there are two elements. There are the Hebrew letters, which are all consonants. There are no vowels in Hebrew. Try and say any word in English without a vowel. There's no such thing. Take your name, pull all the vowels out, try to say it. it doesn't exist. So we have these markings called nikud that show us what vowel sounds to make between the consonants. A traditional Torah scroll doesn't have them. So, and much like many writings in Hebrew, the only way that you can really understand it is getting so comfortable with the material that through context or memorization, you just know what it says. Your average lay person cannot just unroll a Torah scroll and start reading from it. There's a significant learning curve. However, we have books called Chumash. Chumash is a variation of the Hebrew word for the number five. The Greek word you may be familiar with is the word Pentateuch. Right? Anyone heard the word Pentateuch before? Called the Torah, the Pentateuch, the five books, right? The Chumash is what would be in a Torah scroll, but in book form, and it has the vowel points, so it can be read. So many times in synagogues, a Torah scroll will be opened for symbolism's sake, but you'll actually be reading from the Chumash because it's just easier to read. Normally, each Torah section is divided up into seven subsections, allowing seven people to be called up to the Torah each time the Torah is read. Each person, when called, recites the blessings before the reading, reads the section, and then recites the blessing after the reading and returns to his or her seat. Eventually, my dream is that we have a full Torah service where there's enough people who can read and chant from the Torah that we can do that we can bring people up, seven people up every time, and we can read from the Torah and sing from the Torah. That's a dream. That's what I want to do. It's traditional to touch the place where the reading begins in the Torah scroll with the tzitzit, your tassels. Much like we do when we have the Torah procession, to touch it with the tzitzit or to touch it with the siddur, and to kiss your tzitzit or to kiss your siddur, kiss your hand, as a sign of reverence, as a sign of love for the Torah itself. Strict Orthodox groups would only call men to the Torah. Many other organizations, that's not the right word. Many other congregations will bring up men and women. Messianic congregations that are more traditional may call only men, but many encourage both men and women to participate in reading the Torah from the Bima. Only those of age are called, and this is what we were talking about before, bar and bat mitzvah, which means son of the Torah or daughter of the Torah, being the determining factor. A young person's bar or bat mitzvah is the first time they are called publicly to read from the Torah. And there's some other things regarding how the Torah is read and handled within traditional synagogues, and for the sake of time, we're not going to get into that. So, next, the Nir Tamid, the eternal light. We have ours above the Ark, the Aron HaKodesh. It's symbolic of the menorah in the temple, which was always lit, and especially of the middle lamp. So if you've seen a menorah before, and hopefully you have, we have a couple of them on the back bookshelf. That bigger one is a Hanukkiah. That's a menorah made specifically for Hanukkah. The smaller one with only seven arms is a menorah, much like the one that was in the temple. Obviously, it was made of pure gold and it was huge, but not that tiny little thing. But the middle one, the shamash, the servant, was always lit, and any other light within the entire temple was lit using the light from the shamash and the menorah. So because it was always lit, we have the Ner Tamid, this eternal light, which we never unplug and change that bulb whenever it needs to be, to be a reminder of the light that never went out within the temple itself. By the way, it's also symbolic of the Shekinah, the presence of God who dwelt over the cherubim. Traditionally, the Torah scroll is always to be in close proximity to the Ner Tamid, and ours is. Speaking of the menorah, I skipped the menorah on here. Sorry, guys. The menorah or the lampstand, and like I said, we have the little one back there. It was symbolic of the seven-branched menorah of the temple. It represents lots of things. It represents the light of God's Torah, because the menorah was lit. It was torches. It was candles. Lamps, I should say. Oil lamps. It represents the divine presence and his spirit's presence. It represented the requirement of Israel to be the light to the nations. We talked about that this morning. And tradition says that a synagogue should not have an exact replica of the temple menorah. This is, when I read this, when I was studying for it, it made a lot of sense, because growing up, going to different events in traditional synagogues, I always would see menorah, and they would have a weird number of arms. They'd have like five or six or something like that. And I never understood why. I'm like, am I the only one who's seeing this? They got this all wrong. Well, it was intentional, because the idea is to not make an exact replica of the one that was there, only something that reminds us of it. So that's why they do that.
the shofar. You heard us try to blow the shofar in this morning. You know, I'm doing all right if I have my own. I forgot mine. Ryan's just really awesome at it. I'm sorry. The shofar is... Yeah, that's true. The shofar is a ram's horn. Actually, not just a ram. A shofar can be made from the horn of any animal, rabbinically speaking, except a cow. And the reason it can't be made from a cow is because of the golden calf debacle. We don't make it from the cow because the cow was, it was a disgrace. So we don't want to use something that was an image of disgrace in order to honor God. So any horned animal, I guess, that you can make a horn from, you can use to make a shofar. And there's all different animals for ones that are sold. You can get ones that are from the horn of an ibex, and you can get some that are from the horn of a ram, and all sorts of different things. And depending on what country they come from and what sect of Judaism uses different animals and different types. We have a few different ones even back there. The ones we used this morning, the long ones are, what is the animal that they, is it, they're not from ibex. What? They are? Really? Okay, maybe they are. And then we have the littler one. You can see it next to the Bibles. That is, I think that's a ram's horn. Excuse me. The shofar is blown on appropriate holidays, including the Shabbat. It's blown on Rosh Chodesh, the beginning of a new month, which we did this morning also. In Orthodox synagogues, shofarim, the plural of shofar, is the only instrument that's allowed in the building, but that's coming out of style more and more. Even in traditional synagogues, other instruments are being allowed in for the sake of worship. So that's the shofar. The next, the kippah, an arch or a dome or a skull cap. These are little bad boys. The plural of that is kippot. In Yiddish, you may have heard this. This is the word I always heard growing up, a yarmulke. I didn't even know it was called a kippah until I was an adult. But mean the same thing, a skull cap or a small cap. Why do we wear them? We wear them in respect to God. It's a reminder for me that God is always above me. It's a reminder for me to be humble before God. Nowhere in the Torah does it say that we need to wear a kippah. We do see examples of people covering their head when they pray. And in an Orthodox synagogue, you'll see men and women covering their heads, men wearing kippot, women normally wearing scarves or something. I've been to synagogues where they have like almost like doilies. They're these lace things that women will clip on just, you know, to make it separate from what a man would wear. In Israel, a head covering for men is required at all places considered holy. So if you go into a synagogue, or if you go to the Western Wall, the Kotel, or if you go to any of the burial places of the sages, you will have a hard time if you're not wearing a kippah. And some people have learned that the hard way. It's also symbolic of the head covering of the high priest. The high priest would wear a head covering. After the destruction of the temple, and in an attempt to let the synagogue function symbolically as a reminder of the temple, it was taught by the rabbis that men should accept the role of conducting the service and as such should emulate the priests. We know in Yeshua that we're all priests and kings, right? So if we're all priests, then we should be dressed like priests. So wear your kippah. Fact. Wear your kippah. Lastly. Well, second to lastly, penultimately, write that one down. Wow, nothing, guys? Seriously? Penultimate? Anyone know that word? Penultimate? Second to last? I'm just lighting you up. The prayer book, the purple siddur that we use. We have a larger siddur back on the back shelf that's used for more than just Shabbat morning. The siddur. The word siddur means order, like an order of service. We can go through the siddur and we know what prayers we're praying. We know what blessings we're saying. We know what readings we're doing because of the order it's written in the siddur. It's made for us to keep order. What is a siddur? It's just a collection of prayers for all of our normal services. For our daily services, which we don't have here all the time, but in many synagogues, the synagogue is open every day for people to come in for prayer. It's open for Torah services, and it's open for holy days, and we have this siddur for those reasons. A modern prayer book, the ones that we have, contain necessary liturgy for home as well as for the synagogue, and anybody who is learning or experiencing holy days and the Shabbat in your home, there's plenty of things that we don't use, even in our little purple Messianic siddur, that are made specifically for your home. Various groups of Judaism have edited their own Siddurim. That's a plural of Siddur. There's all sorts of different ones, hundreds of them. There's some that are like kind of officially adopted by different flavors of Judaism, but there's so many different ones that there's really no standards. We've chosen this Messianic one. It's not even close to a complete one. It's good enough for us for Shabbat morning, but it's not a complete Siddur. The other art scroll one that we have two, one for weekdays and one for Sabbaths and weekends, and they're good also, but many congregations, especially Messianic ones, end up editing their own, taking from a traditional Siddur that which is appropriate and putting it in an order that's, you know, that works for them. There's nowhere in Scripture that says you have to have a Siddur that works this way, so we have some freedom there. It's a fantastic thing to honor these traditions. These traditions have existed since the days of Yeshua and well before. Why wouldn't we want to connect in that way, traditionally and culturally? Of course, that's why we use it. But there's nowhere that God says this is how you have to, you know, you have to pray the Matovu before you pray the Vahafta. And, you know, it's not like that. Another special Siddur, a smaller one, is called a Machzor. If you were with us for Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur, you had a special little order of service specifically with prayers for those two holy days. That's what the Machzor is. We have an abbreviated one that we use. If you purchase the Machzor, it's much thicker, the, you know, hundreds of pages of prayers specifically for these two holy days. The word Machzor means cycle, and it's a special prayer book for Yom Teruah, the Feast of Trumpets, and Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. Oh, good, I'm doing good. So what's the point? Whole lot of piecemeal information tonight, and I appreciate you guys sticking with me on that. Why should we care about all this stuff? Why do we have it? What do we need it for? You know, God didn't say I need to wear a kippah. God didn't say you have to use a yad when you read a Torah scroll. What is this all about? Well, it's important. I think it's important. It is important to identify with the elements of the temple. Since one day we're going to worship in it again, when Yeshua comes back in the kingdom, there's going to be a temple again. We're going to worship within a temple system. Read Ezekiel. There's going to be sacrifices again in the presence of Yeshua. We're going to do it again. And even though we, as believers today, may be far removed from the temple system that existed, why wouldn't we want to honor Yeshua in the way that he honored God? Why wouldn't we want to honor Yeshua in the way that the Talmudim, the apostles, honored him? Why wouldn't we want to do as much as we could to be like him and be like them? We should. So it's twofold. We're connecting with our spiritual ancestors, and we're also looking forward to the time that we're going to honor him in his presence in a kingdom setting, in a temple setting. Each element reminds us of the story of our redemption. Listen, if Adam and Chava never fell, there wouldn't have been need for a Mishkan, a tabernacle. There would never have been need for a temple, because there would have never been need for sacrifice, because there never would have been death. There never would have been sin, and there would never would have had to be redemption. You don't have to be redeemed if you never fell. But we did. That's the story. That's what we have. And God has redeemed us, and he's promised to redeem us, and he is redeeming us, and he will redeem us finally, and Yeshua is going to return for us. And each element reminds us of this epic saga that we're a part of, this beautiful story God has been weaving since creation. He made us. He loves us. He's bought us back after we sold ourselves off, and he's going to reconcile us once again for good. And all of these elements remind us of that. The ark reminds us of his presence. The light reminds us of his presence. The shofar calls us to repent, to wake up. Why wouldn't we want to use them? So these elements are important, and I hope that in your messianic walk, whether you're established or you're brand new, I hope these things become dear to you. I hope the holy days become dear to you. I hope these days that aren't even necessarily biblical holy days, but they're traditions that we've held on to, things like Simchat Torah, I hope they become dear to you. Not just things you show up for because it's stuff that we're doing, but it becomes stuff that's in your heart. That's how we build a community. We build around these things because they honor Yeshua and because they honor the Torah. And that's what we're doing. So another chapter in the introduction to Torah living has finished. Please pick up the discussion questions so you can study later on this week, and we are set to go. So I'm going to pray, and then we're going to dismiss. Abba, thank you.